Hello, everybody. My name is Christina Rowe, and welcome to the Addiction 911 Show. We're here today with an esteemed panel of guests, panelists in the addiction community, and we're going to be discussing a sensitive topic, blaming the addict. Is it a choice or a disease? So I'm here today with Mark Thompson, who is the director of Archstone Recovery, which I'm going to bring him up in a second. Judy Avoras, who is Wise Care Coaching, is her company. And Dr. Marty Lerner, who is the executive director of Milestones in Recovery. So I'm just going to, first we're going to start over here. I'm going to just mute everybody else. I'm going to start with Judy, and I'm going to have Judy give us a little summary of what she does and how she helps and serves in the addiction community.
Okay.
Judy, can you hear me? Okay, wonderful, Judy. So, Judy, tell us about yourself and how you help your families and people who are affected by addiction.
Well, I've worked in the addictions field for probably about 30-plus years, and I've worked actually with substance users and also with family members. And what I'm doing right now is a private coaching practice that's called Wise Caring. And it specializes in working with family members. And although I still do get referrals to work with the substance user also. And so the way that I've been working with families is, and I was particularly drawn to your topic because of the whole issue of shame and really how detrimental it is to someone who's in recovery to experience blame.
Absolutely.
Because it adds to already their shame and their guilt about addiction.
Absolutely.
And about being an addict. And I think that for family members, they often, they don't want to blame the addict. I don't think that that's ever in their heart or their intention. But I think it's easy to get into blaming because of the behaviors that go along with addiction.
Absolutely. And that's what we're going to discuss today. And I'm going to be giving everyone individual questions about that. We're going to dive deep into this about
right.
The blame. So I'm going to now just put you back into the lobby section, and I'm going to bring up Mark, and let's go over to Marty, Dr. Lerner.
Hi,
how are you?
Great.
Okay. Love you to tell us about Milestones in Recovery, because you have, your Milestones in Recovery is a little bit of a different type of treatment center that you treat primarily eating disorders. Is that correct?
That's correct. I think what makes this a little bit unique, including my participation in this forum, is that most people don't look at eating or food or eating disorders from an addictions perspective. And what's interesting to me is that most of us, both in the public and in the recovering community, professional and otherwise, tend to look at addiction as limited to drugs and alcohol. And it's almost, I don't know, coincidental that the DSM-4 or the psychiatric community has included a process addiction, compulsive gambling into their mix. But bottom line is that there is such a thing as, we'll say, food addiction. And we also treat bulimia, anorexia, binge eating disorder, etc., from an addictions perspective. Just one quick footnote, and that is that in doing that, over the years, I've found and we've found that the majority of patients that we currently see are referred to us from chemical dependency programs where the eating disorder, either being the primary or secondary or comorbid addiction, has taken center stage, and there's a necessity to treat both or address both the chemical dependency and the eating disorder concomitantly. Otherwise, there's a much higher risk of relapse. So what we do is we treat addiction, but we specialize in treating addictions that are inclusive of eating disorders. And that's what I do. anybody home. I'll tell you a little bit about myself since I have a little bit more time to do that. On a personal note, I sort of wear two hats. I have some letters after my name and come from a research background, primarily looking at regulation of appetite when I was in another life. Kind of stumbled across treating people with weight problems and soon learned that the weight was more the symptom and the underlying issue was an eating disorder, usually overconsumptive types like binge eating, compulsive overeating and such. And on the personal note, wearing another hat, my own experiences and relationship with substances and addiction led me to see the bridge between addiction with substances and seeing some types of foods as substances, but a lot of addictive patterns with eating, both on a personal note, but professional note. And so in doing that, my experience expanded to working with professionals, mostly healthcare professionals and docs that were in recovery. And about 30 years ago, went through my own experience at an impaired physicians program, which now they call in Florida, is the Physicians Recovery Network. So I've been an active member of that community and partaking in groups that we facilitate here at Milestones, and taken those experiences and applied them to eating disorders vis-a-vis the prism of addiction. And that's pretty much a good description of how I stumbled into this field some time ago. In any case, I find that, as I'm sure some of the other people that are participating in this forum, that addictions are no longer limited to one substance, that it's really the nature of the person rather than the nature of the substance du jour that's at issue. So whether it's alcohol, which by the way is pure sugar, whether it's cocaine, opiates, whether it's a process addiction like gambling, sex, or shopping, the neurochemistry and the physical, emotional, and I guess we could say spiritual components that need to be addressed are common to all addictions. So I look at it from a generic perspective, and we deal with, and I deal with, people who are looking to go beyond gaining a foothold in recovery from either alcohol and drugs, and now see that they're struggling with and have struggled with other addictions, in particular, their relationship with food and weight. And that would be a good descriptor of what Milestones is about and pretty much professionally and personally what I'm about.
Marty, this is Mark. Can you hear me?
I can.
I've got a question. I've been listening to what you've been saying, and you know, as I've been in the field for, you know, a few years now, I've seen the people who come to Archstone, and we're a drug and alcohol treatment center, and while the drug of choice changes, the demographics tend to change, the geographic areas from which our clients come change. You know, obviously the one thing that stays the same is the shame and the fear, and a lot of that I've found out comes from external to the addict, which goes right to our topic for today. Now, and I was wondering if you find that to be true with those suffering from an eating disorder as well. Do people who have eating disorders get blamed for that?
Yes, and there's a few fronts to consider, Mark. One is, let's draw a parallel to where an alcoholic might have been viewed externally and probably internally as well, maybe 50, 60, 70 years ago, recently as maybe 10 or 20 years ago. And that is the stereotype of the bum under the bridge, that sneakers and trench coat type of thing, the person who's down and out or so on and so forth. And we all know that the majority of people that have drug and alcohol issues, you wouldn't be able to pick out of the crowd. They're the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker.
Right, the bank executive, the airline pilot.
Of course. And with eating disorders, there's an added component. We're about where that description is and where the general public tended to view addiction and alcohol. We're back in 50, 60 years ago.
Can you hear me? I can hear my computer completely crashed. I don't hear anyone. Let me see if I can hear you guys.
You're jumbled. But hang in there with me in the middle
Hello?
Of the conversation. We can hear you now, but just let me finish your thought with Mark and then
I guess you can dive in.
But where I was going with this, Mark, is real simple. You know, with an eating disorder, people have the stereotype that someone looks either skeletal or obese. And the reality is it's the same notion as it is with alcohol and drug addiction. The majority of people with an eating disorder, you wouldn't be able to pick out of the crowd. So someone with binge eating disorder or compulsive overeating may carry a lot of shame, but the shame tends to be body shame rather than a willpower shame or moral shame or something of that sort. But otherwise, it's pretty much identical.
Mm-hmm. And are you back with us, Christina? I think that is it.
I think Christina's having some technical problems.
Sounds like it.
But anyway, you know, to carry this conversation a little bit, shame is inherent in any addiction.
Absolutely. I've certainly found that to be true. I have to admit that when I found that the topic for today's workshop, a little surprised, because here we are in 2007. We've been looking at addiction as a disease now for probably 60 years. We're still having the conversation in our society. Is this a disease or is this a choice? And you know, when we were talking about shame a minute ago, I think that's probably a big part of what fuels this ongoing question that's already been answered. And it's the shame that the person feels making that call, going to that first 12-step meeting. We don't, when we run across somebody who has lung cancer, for instance, very frequently that began with a cigarette. But we don't look at that person and go, oh, you horrible person, the same way that society tends to look at the alcoholic or the drug addict, be they the airline pilot, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, and blame them. And, you know, it's really kind of sad, because this is a disease and it needs to be treated as a disease. And the sooner we can get that message out, I think the better off the population that we all serve is going to be.
So can you hear me?
Absolutely.
I don't even know if I'm in. Am I in on the show now?
Let's put it this way. The three of us are going to have a conversation, and Christina is going to drink some coffee and try to figure out what went on.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Marty.
So why don't you tell us a little bit where you're in.
I just wanted to respond to what you guys were saying. I find that in some ways more interesting. So I totally agree with you, Marty, that there is food addiction. And I think it should be treated just like any other. I mean, what I would say, I would treat it as any other habit. And because I really look at, I look at addictions as it's a human habit. And we have all kinds of different varieties of habits that we do. The difference between kind of an innocent habit and an addiction is it's repeated more and there's more serious consequences, more of an impact.
Sure. And I just wanted to say something, not to create controversy, but two things just for us to discuss, because I think we're probably preaching to the choir in this audience to some degree, right. but here's the thing. What I find, and I'm just going to talk about addiction as a generic term, just for the moment, whether it's alcohol, drugs, food, or whatever. One thing is that even with the lung cancer example, there are people that will always ask, well, were you a smoker? And whether they acknowledge it or not, the non-smoker does have a prejudice and bias and looked at that, or looks at that as, well, you caused this yourself as opposed to someone who doesn't. But my main thesis here, what I would ask you guys, because I'm curious, wearing a personal hat here and being part of the recovery community, I find that chip systems, demarcation, lengths of sobriety, et cetera, there's still shame within the recovering community.
Absolutely.
About relapse. So when you talk about a disease, even within our own tribe, people still are shame-based, even in their own recovery. And even though the science of addiction and the professional community and the ASAM docs and on and on and on know that relapse is symptomatic of a disease. We talk about remission, not cure, but the expectation within the recovering community more often than not is shame about relapse. And that is blaming the victim.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of judgment. There's a whole lot of judgment in the addictions community. Just like you're saying, I mean, I saw it over and over and over again in different treatment settings, and it's unconscious. A lot of it is actually unconscious. So I'm really glad that you're bringing this forward, because even as treatment professionals, we get into that cycle of, how many days have you been sober? Have you relapsed? And you're right. That's part of the process of healing. Is that, you're going to probably relapse. It's not going to be a straight line in your recovery.
Yeah, it's not a self-fulfilling prophecy necessarily, but I'm curious, when you say unconscious, I'm not sure how you...
In other words, I don't think within the treatment community, I don't think that they realize sometimes how shame-based it is. And that they're carrying those attitudes.
Can I make a suggestion? I'm not a technician, but can you turn off the volume somehow? Because we're getting a lot of feedback.
Turn off the volume? I don't know how to turn off the volume.
Well, can you both hear someone speaking over?
A little bit.
A little bit or a lot?
I don't hear it.
Oh. Okay, good. Good. So if it's only me, I'll deal with it. Okay.
I can try taking my headphones off. How's that?
No, that won't matter.
That's.
Is that better?
Yeah, it's okay.
It's all right. We'll deal with it.
To go back to that point about shame within the community, I got to take a little bit of exception to even within, the treatment community, we're shaming, but definitely the addict themselves, when they experience relapse, when the person is describing what happened, very frequently, it's been my experience, they won't say I relapsed or I had a slip. It's I effed up. It's a statement of self shame.
Right.
And that is probably the biggest part of why I do what I do, is to try to help these people understand that they suffer from a disorder. Like Marty was saying, it doesn't matter if it's cocaine, Jack Daniels, you know, bacon cheeseburgers or heroin. It's not about the substance, it's about the behaviors. And we need to treat the person from the inside out. It's not about the substance or the habit, it's about the person.
All this, go ahead, I'm sorry.
And I was gonna say, and getting to the core of the shame within the person is key to helping them rebuild their life.
Here's a question, guys. I mean, and I'm asking this more from a personal as well as somewhat of a professional standpoint, but having some familiarity with a 12-step recovery program, how much of this do you think intellectually we'll all agree? Probably if you polled 100 people who regularly attend an AA meeting or an NA meeting or an OA meeting or whatever A meeting and said, you know, relapse is part of the disease. No one really should feel ashamed about it. It takes a lot of courage to come back and pick up a wife and yada, yada, yada. Everybody, I think, would subscribe to the party line. But deep down inside, I think what we're really doing battle with is a sick ego. I wonder how much this has to do with, you know, with that component. And that despite hearing, I know personally, I've heard it, I don't know how many times, that, you know, a slip or a relapse, a decent regret is enough, but to beat yourself up and feel that you failed, you know, is totally distorted. But it's me, not you, that relapsed.
And not only is it totally distorted, but it actually adds to the problem.
Right. You're right.
In other words, if we go into self-judgment, we've actually nailed it in, nailed the addiction in deeper.
Good point.
Because that now we're back, really back in the soup of our thinking, of our feeling about being addicted. And so we, it's like if we could even change that, let people know that actually that makes everything even worse. It takes us in the wrong direction. Because from my point of view, addiction actually, for me, isn't a choice or a disease. What it is it's a misunderstanding of how thought is generating our experience in every moment.
That is an interesting one. Let me throw out a thought to you and see if you guys feel I'm out in left field or whatnot. But let's see if I can frame this without sounding from the outer limits. But all of us do self-talk. All of us have a dialogue. Matter of fact, if I had someone that I knew that talked to me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, I'd take them out and shoot them.
Yeah, and that's right. Absolutely.
That does that. And I'm not going to shoot myself.
Yeah.
But a lot of that talk, if I start to, I don't know, use part of the program to become aware and listen to what I'm saying to myself, and then just by virtue of becoming aware of it, seeing it for what it is, I've got a shot at moving beyond that.
That's absolutely, yes.
That space between what I'm identifying as me is, you know, moving over to what I would call, this is just my own experience, that's where spirituality lies.
Yes.
Absolutely. You get it? For me, part of dealing with the shame has a lot to do with not connecting the dots and knowing that my dad, my mom, or whatever said what and what, but simply right now, right here, you know, making a committed effort to stop and take a look at what I'm telling myself.
We have to learn how to think about the way we think.
how do we teach people to do that?
Meditation.
Well, I think that
that's where I start with them is meditation.
Yeah, and I think meditation is really helpful. But I also think that just understanding, starting to understand the nature of thought, how it actually works inside of us as a human being.
You think these guys were thinking of that when they wrote an 11th step?
I don't know. I have no idea.
That's interesting.
Actually, but...
But I totally am on the same page that you guys are on with this.
Yeah.
You realize
that. So for me, it's like, once you can start to, like you were saying, Marty, once you can start to see, these are thoughts that are being generated all the time in my mind.
Right.
And they have to do with, you know, a lot of them have to do with self-criticism, self-judgment,
especially
for the addict. It's like once you can actually start to see that and realize that that thought doesn't mean anything about you. It's just thought that's running. So there's a way that, and meditation really helps with this because you can start to disidentify from those thought patterns. And then you realize, oh, well, that's not me. It's the thought that's just being generated in my mind.
But the key phrase is it's not me.
That's right.
And at least debate that piece. Then what you're really doing is you're refuting the shame.
And what happens when you do that is that you start to fall in to your own resiliency. You start to actually get in touch with, like you said, the spiritual side of yourself. And the way that I use this with family members is because a lot of their feelings about the addict are being generated by their thoughts about it. And they don't actually see that.
So
to see that, just like what you were saying, once they can start to disidentify from their thoughts, all of a sudden they have more access to their own resilience and their own wisdom in terms of relating to the addict in a different way.
So it begs the question.
I don't want to interrupt you. I just want to let you know that I'm back. I'm really sorry about my computer completely crashed. You guys are doing
your job. You're still not coming in clearly.
You can't hear me.
I can hear you, but I'm hearing you in very choppy, poor reception.
Okay, how about now? Is that better?
Only if I could read lips.
Oh, okay. I'm not really sure what's going on here. I'm going to take myself out if you can hear me. I'm going to put Mark back in. But I just want, can you guys hear me right now? I have one question that I wanted to ask. I wanted to put the three of you back into debate. And Judy has started to speak on this. It's about people feeling very angry toward the addict. I've had conversations with people, and I used to actually feel this way too. You know, well, it's a choice. The first time that they actually took that drug or alcohol, they made the choice to do it, and then like you guys discussed, it turned into a disease. But people, because of all the heartache and everything that they experienced dealing with an addict, you know, addicts steal from them and the lies and all the different things, they become very angry toward them. So I think maybe, like Judy was starting to talk about, how we can turn that around to make people have more compassion and understand deeply how torturous the experience of addiction is. Unless you know somebody who's gone through it, or you've gone through it, then you can see it, that these people don't want to hurt other people. That's not, you know, something's driving them. It's almost like a demon addiction that drives them beyond their control. And I think a lot of people don't understand that, you know, watching, they figure out that, you know, they're just making that choice. So yeah, I'm going to put Mark back up if you guys want to bring a little bit of that into, so we can help educate people who are watching, who have loved ones, who are judging and, you know, and not feeling the compassion for them. So I'm going to bring Mark back in, and let me just grab him here. Mark, are you still there?
So did you want me to respond to that, or I guess I'm not.
Well, I think all of us need to respond to it. Mark, why don't you respond?
Well, I was going to say that, you know, I've always believed that if you want to get a glimpse into hell, look into the eyes of a suffering addict. And if you are a family member, if you are someone who has been at the receiving end of the stealing, the lies, the betrayals, all of it, sometimes it's difficult, I think, to see past all that, to see the suffering. And so education, I think, is the key to helping turn some of this around. You know, in my own experience, I'm a member of the recovering community myself, and my family had to deal with my addictive disorder. And you know, my family, they didn't understand until they had the opportunity and the motivation to go out and educate themselves about what it was about. And once they did, they started dealing with me differently. And that's probably the primary reason why when I'm working with a client, I am saying, I want to pull your family into this. And then the families, I need you to go to Al-Anon. I need you to educate yourself. I need you to become aware of what it is your loved one is dealing with so that you can learn, A, that you're not alone. B, it isn't about you as a parent, a brother, a sister, a husband, a wife. And C, learn some tools for dealing with this. I found it to be very effective.
Okay, a question. Has it been your personal experience that the compassion, the understanding, the willingness to go to Al-Anon and those things that you outlined, did they happen when you were making that effort at recovery, or was this before you even acknowledged you had a problem?
In my personal case, it was after the fact. And very frequently when I'm working with people, I have to educate the family about what Al-Anon is.
Right.
And so again, for them, it's after the fact as well.
Right.
It takes quite a bit of insight, I think, to be able to say, well, you know, in the pre-contemplative state to say,
right,
okay, there's some education that needs to take place here.
Well, and I think that also it's really important to understand that the family is suffering tremendously.
Absolutely.
The addict is suffering and the family is suffering. And again, I want to go back to this whole thing of what's actually happening when we're suffering. You know, where is our experience coming from? Because really, just like Marty, you were saying about thought, a lot of our suffering is coming from what mind state we're in at any particular time. Right. And the families are in a mind state of worry, of fear, anger a lot of times at the behavior. But all those experiences. Mm-hmm. And so, and then, you know, that creates all of those feelings. But right. The thing is that people don't stop to actually realize, oh, this is all my thought. These are all my thinking about what's going on, the situation, what the addict is doing, his behavior. And so then they're just at the mercy. We're always at the mercy of our thinking if we don't see that that's what's happening. And that's why meditation is so important. It's like, you know, that's one of the things that can really help us to disidentify from that so that we can have more clarity.
I call it taking our minds off of autopilot.
Pardon? Yeah.
Taking our brain off autopilot. Becoming aware. Becoming centered in right now. And to go back to your point, Judy, the family, yeah, they're suffering too, and they're trying to wrap their heads around what's going on.
That's right.
Meanwhile, the mind state of the addict is this, and that perpetuates what's going on in the family, and so it becomes this very destructive cycle over time.
Yeah,
and it takes a lot of work to get through that.
And I would say that the family members also are experiencing this, but they're just experiencing their own version of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. No different.
I have two scenarios. I'd be curious to see what your take is on this. And in the population I deal with, and the populations you're dealing with, there is a lot of anger, and some of it is justifiable or expected. And even as a person within the recovering community, I find myself at times judgmental, despite what I know and what I'm aware of. Case in point, someone knows that they're an alcoholic, or they know that they're a drug addict, or they know that they've been hospitalized 3 times and bankrupted their family practically because they're either anorectic or their health is being jeopardized by their eating disorder or addiction. Anyway, so the alcoholic goes out, gets behind the wheel of a car and kills somebody. There's any number of scenarios. And where I'm coming from with all of this is, yes, it is a disease, but reality is that society holds us responsible despite our addiction. So if I go out and relapse, yes, it's a mitigating circumstance, but I still am responsible for what I do. So there's kind of this conundrum of yes, it's a disease. No, you shouldn't feel shame. And there shouldn't be roadblocks to your getting help, provided you want it. But there are people out there, as we all know this, don't want help, and just say, F it. And we all pay a price for that. So I'm wondering how we resolve that. I mean, in other words, the purpose of Al-Anon, in my limited understanding, you could ask my wife, she's been promoted to a 4-star general there. but the purpose of Al-Anon is to not try and control the addict, the alcoholic, or the bulimic or anorectic, but rather to not neither enable or suffer the consequences of someone else's actions, and at the same time not try to control their behavior or their recovery or lack thereof. So it's never black and white.
Yeah, and the thing is that for me, it's a lot of times we actually don't look at what works and what doesn't work in our relationships with human beings, right? And trying to control someone, well, it just doesn't work. So for me, there's no judgment about that or anything else, but I can see very clearly, well, that doesn't work to try to control another human being. So, when I work with families, I always approach it from the point of view of, okay, number one, you deeply care about your loved one who's addicted. That's number one. And given your level of understanding, you're doing the best that you can. And so their level of understanding is, I have to try to control this person. I have to try to get him to change, or her, or whoever. And that actually doesn't work. So what are some things that actually work? And, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Kraft.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Excellent family treatment.
Mm-hmm, true.
And, one of the main things they talk about is you need to listen. Now, you really need to listen to the person who's addicted. And that doesn't any way mean that you condone their behavior. Or you have to suffer, you have to be in the presence of their behavior, whatever else, you have to be honest about what your limits are. But to continue to listen and to have some kind of connection, I think is very important. However you do that within the limits of your own, with your own limitations.
Right. And forming that connection, though, is very difficult when there's so much hurt, so much damage And so, yeah, absolutely, it's necessary. Yeah. How do you get there, though?
Well, the way that you get there is that I think, number one, you have to be really honest with yourself. What are you actually capable of doing? You know, what are you in terms of being exposed to that person's behavior? I mean, that's, you have to start there, because otherwise, how would you know when you could connect with them? You know, what would be an acceptable way to connect with them? But for me to totally, and sometimes, hey, sometimes family members just have to, you know, disconnect for a while. But that's also a limit that they have.
So is the starting place helping the family?
I think it's both. I think you have to be helping the addict and the family. But the thing is that if you start to listen and actually ask questions, try to find out about their experience, what's going on for them, you know, and not step way back with trying to control them, because it doesn't work. And also, I think that, you know, looking at your own process, you know, what you're thinking, what's all the thinking that's going on for you around having a child or a spouse that's addicted? Because there's a lot of thinking that family members do about this whole situation. And often they're not even aware that that's what's creating a lot of their feelings.
So, and a lot of suppressed emotions as well.
Yes, exactly. And so then if you don't give them the opportunity to start to have some kind of understanding of how thought works for them, they're just going to be in the soup of it all the time. And they're not going to be able to listen. They're not going to be able to extend, you know, compassion and all those things that actually create the best container for somebody to change.
But this is all for a stage in which a family is dealing with someone who isn't either willing, ready, or able to enter recovery, as opposed to someone who is willing to go into recovery.
No, I don't agree with that. Seeing somebody right now whose son is very, very active in his addiction.
Uh-huh.
And because he has started to learn, number one, to listen. Number two, to communicate to the addict in a way that actually solicits his own self-reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And he's found out, okay, I know what my limits are. This family member has said, you can't live in my house if you're using. So he's also gone through a process of discovering what his limits are, the ones that he can stick by. What happened is his son actually wrote him a letter saying that, you know, he does want to change and these are all the things that he wants to change. Well, that's a first step for that substance user.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was coming in
actually contemplate change.
I was coming from a little bit of a different place. The population that I'm dealing with, let's just say they're duly diagnosed.
Yeah.
Let's say drug addiction and bulimia, just picking these out of a hat. What usually will happen is, 18%. Can you hear my eye watch?
Yes.
Yes. I'm about to shoot it. Can you help me with that? Because I don't want to do that. Okay. Anyway, got to figure out what that voice is or who that is. Got a real resentment. Anyway, we see people typically that the family, okay, wants the patient to stop hurting themselves. In my case, binging, purging, or starving themselves to death, or eating themselves to death. It really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So the person's here, whether it's, you know, 4 weeks, 4 months, 4 years, doesn't matter. So they're abstinent from their drug du jour, whatever. And then they dealing with the family bargained for, they're not jumping off the roof and killing themselves, but they didn't bargain for them getting healthy. So one of the things that I tell people about the shame and the other piece is that, it, you know, be careful what you pray for, because as that person gets well, two things I've seen happen. Acts of independence in family systems become acts of betrayal. And that when people are in recovery and are firmly planted in recovery, albeit maybe for 6 months or a relatively short time, they start to assert themselves and no longer are feeling as shame-based, and will say, for instance, in a marriage, you know, I'd like to have a say in how we're spending our money, or I'd like to pick the restaurant, or I'd like to pick the movie, or, and there's this disequilibrium. I know in my own experience, it wasn't in a marriage, it was in a relationship with parents, you know, very young. And what would end up happening subtly is as I started to get better, my parents were out of the job.
Mm-hmm.
And right. So there's this, there's, you know, so the shame, you know, can get resolved to some degree. The problem is the backlash. And I think, unless I'm mistaken, sometimes what happens is the shame on the family's end, feeling ashamed of their son, ashamed of their husband, or ashamed of whomever, takes that and they get past the shame, and then the next piece is anger or rage.
Sure, and I think that goes right back to the heart of what we're talking about, because this, regardless of the substance,
right,
this is not an individual disorder. Just because I'm the one who's sick doesn't mean I haven't infected the people around me.
That's a good way to put it.
And so, you know, recovery doesn't always fix marriages. Sometimes recovery ends marriages. And it's sad, but it's true. And the reason being is these two people or this family has learned how to do a dance. And and throughout the course of the years of the addiction, the dance may be extremely destructive. You know, walking into walls, stepping on toes, whatever metaphor you want to use. The addict goes away, comes to Archstone Treatment Center or Milestones, and suddenly they're being taught how to do a different dance. And they stay for 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, whatever. And then they go back into that environment. What they walk back into is an environment of people who want to continue to do the same dance. And it doesn't work. If the person has internalized the principles of recovery, yet they go back into an environment where the other people want them to assume all the same roles they did before, there's going to be conflict. And Judy, well, this is where your work comes in so vital.
But the thing is that, you know, using, let's just use that example. The addict gets well and they come home and they've learned a lot, right? They've learned a lot in treatment. They're different. They're taking responsibility for themselves. They're taking responsibility for their recovery. And what I see is that there's, because in a way you could say, and I know this is a concept that's been talked about, but the addict becomes the focus of their world when they're in their addiction.
Sure.
And
by necessity.
Well, I wouldn't say by necessity, because if they start to see what's going on inside of themselves and that they're definitely in their own process.
I was talking about, like, well, now I have to go pick up the kids. I have to do the grocery shopping. I have to pay the bills. I have to, and it all becomes very centered on the app.
Right. On a very practical level, yes, they have to do a lot of that kind of stuff. But still in all, if they haven't looked at their own internal process, if they haven't looked at what's getting created in their own emotional life, then they're not going to be prepared for the addict being well.
Right. They have to learn to do a new dance.
So, yeah. You know, Julia.
They also have to learn to change their focus, but also they have to see that whatever they're experiencing is happening inside of them. Just for all of us, that's true. My whole thing is to actually help them increase their understanding of their own process, of their own, how their feelings get created.
I agree with what you're saying. I think I would reframe it as that, because I think you said it before, the addict in recovery can use different semantics, but after a while, they're recovered. Not permanently, yes. But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So their identity needs to be recovered addict. But by the same token, the family needs to assume or drop the identity of having to be a parent of an irresponsible addict.
Well, and you can imagine that's quite a change, right?
Yeah.
That's a change for family members, and they need support to make that transition,
But they need to become aware that they're telling themselves, if you want to frame it that way, old tapes. And that Southwest commercial where they go into the bathroom, the woman's in the bathroom, and she just, can't help herself. She looks through the medicine cabinet, and it all crashes down, and want to get away kind of a thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that. And, after 20 or 30 years of recovery, why is the family still hiding the Ativan and the Percocet,
So I just want to, I really have to say this because I think this is so important. We keep making a distinction between the addict and the family. We need to stop making that distinction. We need to understand that we are all here in a human experience. The family is having their experience of addiction. The addict is having his experience or her experience of the addiction. We're not separate. We are all in this, thought-generated feeling of addiction all the time, both families and addicts. I get so tired of hearing it. This the family, this the addict. We're all in this process together, and we're all experiencing a lot of the same feelings. The family is having a lot of the same feelings that the addict is having. They have shame, they have anger, they have guilt. They all are the same. All the same.
So that's why I said, that everybody becomes infected. And it's true.
But it's a human experience we're having. Families are right here in it, and so are the addicts. And we need to be supporting them in the same way. And to help them understand how their experience is getting created so that they can see through it and not identify with it. That's what gives us all freedom as human beings.
It's interesting that addiction is the disease of self-obsession. And the deeper one goes into it, the more and more one becomes isolated. However, it's not an individual disorder. We're all in it.
Yeah.
We isolate, yet we project. And yes, system. We have to deal with the entire system.
Yeah.
Right.
The assumption is you cannot treat successfully or expect a good outcome in recovery for someone that is dealing with the disease of addiction unless you're also addressing the contagion that has infected, as Mark's saying, the entire tribe.
We need to be treating the entire tribe. We need, families should be getting as much treatment as the addict.
And so
I've always felt that, and it's never happened in my experience in the treatment community.
And the reason being is because the family says things like, I'm not the one who's sick, he's the one who's sick.
Yeah, but that's a misunderstanding. That's basically a misunderstanding.
Of course.
So how do we, what you were saying, Mark, is how do we educate people to realize that that's a misunderstanding. That's all it is.
So programs that are inpatient or residential for codependency, like Karen Foundation or some of the components we may all have in doing family therapy, really do need to address whether we call it codependency or trust and control issues or Al-Anon based or whatever. It, you know, you only have one, what I'm hearing is you only have one half of the equation or the formula in recovery if you're only treating, you know, the identified patient instead of
absolutely.
Yeah, I want everyone to be supported through this process.
Right.
It's one of the most challenging human experiences that we have.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with that. It's very difficult to do that. Like Mark is saying, when the family wasn't bargaining for that, they send someone to rehab or a program or anything that we're doing and say, fix them. Make them stop binging, purging, restricting, drinking, drugging, you know, cutting whatever they're doing, and send them back home. I mean, that is the mentality that you usually see. Or you have someone that's an addict in the family that's sending their offspring to treatment, but they have no intention of stopping themselves. Mm-hmm. That's another variant of all of this.
Yeah, and I think that if we can understand, you know, if we can really see that it is a misunderstanding, that has, you know, perpetuated itself in treatment, you know, the whole treatment community, that we could change, that we could really change some things.
But don't you see families also that blame themselves? What did I do wrong?
Of course.
Sure. I mean, everybody has a different way of doing it. It depends on the individual.
So right? There's anger and there's guilt.
Yeah, some people blame themselves. Some people blame others, you know.
Especially ones that have Jewish mothers.
Whatever.
Yeah.
And I think part of the danger becomes, it becomes a cycle. You know, the family member blames the addict gets defensive, lashes out at the family, but then turn around again, confront the addict, and it becomes this highly toxic relationship.
Right. And if you can't see where that's coming from, then you're just lost in it.
Right. And unfortunately, it's usually coming from a place of self-injury, self-hurt, shame, guilt, fear. And we can't see past it to learn how to deal with the other.
So did you see that little message across the bottom of the screen? Supposed to give our contact information.
Yeah.
So well, I'll just get mine real quick.
Ladies first.
Oh, thank you. You guys have been great. So the name of my business is Wise Caring, and you can find out about more about me and my work at www.wisecaring.com. And also I have a Facebook page, which is www.facebook.com/wisecaring. And you can email me at JAVORU, and my last name's a little difficult, so I'm going to spell it UZ@wisecaring.com. So thank you guys so much. I've really enjoyed this.
Great. Thank you, Judy.
So
Marty, go ahead.
Well, you know my name, Marty Lerner. The easiest way to contact me would be just Google Milestones in Recovery and or Marty Lerner or Dr. Marty Lerner, what have you. And you'll get information that'll lead you to being able to contact us. Otherwise, it's milestonesprogram.org.
And you can reach me at artstonerecovery.com. My email address is mthompson@artstonerecovery.com. And you can find us on Facebook under Archstone Recovery Center. And I would like to thank both Marty and Judy. This has been very, very interesting.
And I hope you guys can hear me now. I just want to thank all three of you for being on the show today. You guys did a wonderful job, and that's why I kept myself in the lobby instead of putting myself on screen, because you guys didn't need me. You were fantastic. Really, really great. Great job. Everything flowed perfectly. I have my list of questions, and you guys were like, actually – without seeing my questions or answering the questions. So it was perfect. And I hope it's going to help a lot of people who are watching. So you guys, like I told you before, put your information also in the comments section of this Facebook Live broadcast so people can click on that to connect with you directly. And I'm so happy that we were here today. And our next show, Addiction 911 show, is going to be on July 27th. And that is going to be all about finding the right treatment center and the right match for your addicted loved one or yourself. So I want to thank everybody today again. I'm sorry again for the tech. My computer literally like blew up. It started making this crazy blue screen and sound. So it's thank God it's back. But you guys didn't need me. Like I said, you did a wonderful job. So thank you so much, everybody. And I will talk to you soon.